This is Betty Trunell speaking for the Decatur Public Library. Our guest today is Donald Opadal, and the narrator is Mr. Opadal, and the interviewer is Betty Trunell. We are making this recording at the Decatur Public Library on May 24th, 1985. Well, Mr. Opadal, I'm going to call you Don because we're good friends. Don, you had a career in the armed services, I believe. In what branch did you serve?
United States Navy. I was in the medical department of the Navy.
Good. I believe you're retired now. What rank do you have, or in what status are you retired?
I retired as Master Chief Hospital Corpsman. That's the highest rank in the non-commissioned officers.
Uh-huh. Yes, I'm sure that a lot of us will be non-military people who won't know some of the terms or the information and so on. So.
But to many of them, it would be E9 in today's vernacular.
Now you're getting a little too technical for us. But if I don't understand some of the terms you use, I'll just ask you to explain.
Okay.
For the sake of other people in my condition. Well, you're not a native of Decatur, I know. How's it happened that you retired and stayed in Decatur?
Well, as you know, we aren't, we're very mobile in the Navy as personnel. We go to sea and then we come back ashore. So I came back from a ship that I'd been on board for 3 years, and I was transferred here to Decatur to take over the medical department at the Lakeshore Naval Reserve Center back in 1956.
It could be almost odd to think of the Navy being in Decatur, but does our lake qualify to work in the Navy?
Believe it or not, many activities, really training activities, go on with the use of our lake, such as diving, and there's some boating goes on too. I haven't been with them close here in the last few years, but I'm sure that they are still getting wet now and then.
Now, there are active branches of the Navy here in Decatur right now?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I understand that they're almost full complemented.
And they conduct these tests that you mentioned?
Well, they have a whole lot of other things. They're a basic training center. Young men who come in to the Naval Reserve from the Decatur community receive the basic introduction to the Navy right there at the center, both in theory and practice.
Where is this center?
Down on Lakeshore Drive.
Mm-hmm.
A beautiful site. It's right next to Mueller Park.
Is it open to the public to look at it or not?
They have open house days annually, so it's announced, and everybody's welcome at that time. Oh, you could go down there, and I'm sure they wouldn't turn you down to go around and see.
Well, now, you just decided you like Decatur?
Well, I have to tell you a story. When I first reported to the station, I hit a bunch of negative attitude boys down there, boys, men, about Decatur. And I always remembered when I first came in from the west into Decatur, the sign out there said 56,000 residents. And I was impressed by what I saw in Decatur. I wouldn't stand for that bad mouthing that was going on. I could understand because they were younger and they were sailors, and they were not getting the kind of life they'd been used to in large naval areas in the East Coast or the West Coast. This is a dry dock here. So I didn't pursue it any further, but I always did like Decatur. I thought it had a good balance of the things that good people like. And for myself, it was natural in every way. I had children who were eligible for school, and the schools that I wanted them to go to were right almost next door. My wife was interested in the things that she had almost in the neighborhood, and so it was, I guess, all in all, to me, it was a plus to find Decatur. I never knew about Decatur in my life until I got my orders to come here. There's a Decatur, Alabama. There are Decaturs all over the country. There's a Decatur in Indiana. And I didn't know what I was getting into, but I liked it when I was here. I had 4 years of it while I was here.
Good. Well, I'm sure Decatur has benefited from your staying here, and we'll talk about that later. But let's go back to your how you happened to get into the service in the first place. Were you drafted, or did you volunteer, or what?
My fiance, who became my wife the next year, on December 7th, she and I were on the highway returning home from the hospital where my father was laid.
Excuse me, was this December 7th, 1941?
1941.
That is usually what people mean by December 7th.
That's
all right,
right,
now go on. You were coming home from the hospital.
I was on the highway when we got it on the radio. Of course, I had an inkling before that. I was a little bit older than the average young man at the time. I was about 4 years older. I always was 4 years older in the service. But that's beside the point. And so I got back in, got back home, and the first thing was to get in. There wasn't any question about it. I had a brother and sister, and my brother couldn't get in. He had poor eyesight. But he didn't object to my wanting to go. There was a terrific loyalty back in those days, a patriotism that I haven't seen since. Everybody, I mean, some were even married and willing to give up being with their family of many children to want to go in. But when it got to me on the recruiting station, I had been carrying a draft card. But when I went down to the station, I enlisted.
Where was this, Don?
Mason City, Iowa.
Mm.
And believe it or not, I asked them if I could enlist for 20 years. The recruiter thought I was out of my mind. But I did take six. And that set the course for the rest of my career. Because the war did not last 6 years. So there I was, the last of the Mohicans, still having to go to work.
Were you sorry?
Not at all, because they were sorry. They were coming back to me, oh, I wished I'd never left the Navy. It was not so good outside.
Yeah.
There was a lack of work, and, well, things were kind of disjointed or disorganized, you know, yet after the war,
mm-hmm.
And everybody had come out of a sort of a regimented life, and they missed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the fortune of advancing rapidly. When 1946, I was, at that time, I was top non-commissioned officer mm-hmm. then. Mm-hmm. We only had 7 grades at that time. Mm-hmm. And I was in the Naval Hospital at St. Albans, New York. And we were full house, 2,000 to 3,000 mm-hmm. men who were still hospitalized as casualties mm-hmm. from World War II.
Don, let's go back to your early life, where you were born and where you grew up and went to school and so on. Was that in Iowa?
Right. Mm-hmm. Like they say in Hee Haw, I was born in the town's 250. It's Stanhope, Iowa. It's a little town right almost dead center of Iowa. Practically a family town. I don't know if there was any that wasn't related to one another. And that's where I got my education. I went on from there to... I entered into a Bible school for a while. I wasn't able to finish because my father needed me at home, and that put a damper to that. Now, this goes before the war. Mm-hmm. This goes before World War II. I had always wanted education. That was my goal in life from the time I was just a young kid in elementary school. I would have been one of those professional students if I could have gotten away with it.
You enjoyed school.
I enjoyed school. I excelled in all grades, and it was just fun for me. I helped a lot of others who didn't make it quite as easy. And back in those days, I'm one of the products of the one-room school.
But you had a good background there.
I think I had. Mm-hmm. I've always felt that I was running with the rest of them who were supposedly in better schools, better equipped schools, and all that sort of stuff. But I never felt short. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I have never quit studying either, mm-hmm. as far as that goes. I love to read. I love to associate with well-educated people. And fortunately, as a medical person in the medical department, I was associating with educated people, mm-hmm. doctors, dentists, nurses, all of it had college mm-hmm. degrees, you know.
Yes.
So I was very much at home with it.
All right. Maybe we could go into your experiences then in World War II. After you enlisted, what happened to you?
My first assignment, well, I was put through training school for the medical attendant or medical assistant. They call it Corps School up at Great Lakes. And my first permanent assignment was Chelsea Naval Hospital in near Boston. And my first assignment in the hospital was surgical assistant. And I was trained to assist the surgeons in operations. It didn't make any difference what it was. Well, it so happened that I took a real interest in brain surgery. And I became the chosen one for one of the best brain specialists in the country, Dr. White. He's in Boston. He's probably passed away now. I lost track. And we did many, many cases. I worked with some of the renowned doctors from New York and Boston in both orthopedic and general mm-hmm. surgery. I also have a first in that hospital. My chief of surgery was a man that was always a little exploring. We had an emergency come in one day, and he just, an emergency appendectomy is what it was. And so I moved the patient into the operating room. We had to take, everything was full, so we had just one little operating room left. I had one nurse, she was circulating, and I was scrubbed up to assist him. I got up to the table, I went on the assistant's side. He told me to get over to the other side. I knew right away what it was. I was to operate. I had never put a knife to anybody in my life. I had seen it done 1,000 times, you know. Would you believe we started and finished that operation in 15 minutes? I am sewed up and out of the operating room. But everything was my way. I mean, I opened up and the appendix popped up like it was on a spring.
And of course, he was watching to make sure that...
Oh, absolutely, yeah. No, but we had been together so much, I had assisted him so much, that he had finally... this was the time he was going to put me to the test. Mm-hmm. This is one of the highlights in my life. In that same hospital, I had another life-saving experience. We were called an emergency about 2 o'clock in the morning. It was a cesarean, and everything went fine. We delivered a little one, a little boy, and put him over into the incubator, and we were starting to close up. You know what that means, suturing up. The circulating nurse, they're the ones, you know, that move around and bring stuff to the surgeons and all that sort of thing. She yelled out, she said, "The baby's blue." And without second thought, I broke scrub. I took my gloves off and I ran over to that little incubator and I took that child and I did artificial mouth-to-mouth respiration we hadn't even heard of it yet. And that little baby screamed.
Uh-huh.
And the girl, she just panicked. And it was, to me, it was a real experience.
Mm-hmm. And what a thrill for the family.
Yeah. A thrill for the family it was, because that mother was there, and she had seen me and known me before they gave him a little bit of anesthesia, you mm-hmm. know. But she, the day she was taking the baby home, she had to come back and find me
thank
me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, now, were these casualties that you were mentioning, of course, not the mother, but the others, like the emergency appendectomy, were they casualties that had happened someplace in the Navy where they were stationed and then flown in, or were they people who were around that area?
Well, there's a mix. When you have these large naval hospitals, you get a mix first of all, let's go back to their locations. They're always located in a very densely populated naval area. Either these are ports, they're near ports where there are lots of ships, or they'll be near where there's a naval base, mm-hmm. and there are a lot of people living on the base. So you get a mix of both casualties and the routine run-of-the-mill illnesses, you know, or emergencies that come up. See, we take care of all of the family of the Navy,
mm-hmm.
the ones who are on active
mm-hmm.
duty.
Mm-hmm.
I want to stick with Chelsea for just a little bit, because that was the first association I had with what was going on in the world. if you recall history, we were having a transport of supplies in the North Sea across by Greenland through the straits over to Russia. We were using merchant marine ships manned by Navy guards because we had, well, up there near Newfoundland, they used to call it German Submarine Alley. And we were getting these casualties from the ships that had been hit by these submarines and blown up, and these men thrown out in that ice cold water, so that what they had was submersion, overexposure, and I saw gangrene and that sort of thing setting in, you know, and we had to deal with that.
Were these men flown then to Chelsea?
They weren't flown at that time. That was before that good day. We didn't have helicopters yet, but they got there eventually. Sometimes it wasn't soon enough. But that was my first hands-on experience of what the war was going on about, because I had been pretty well sheltered. I was a year and a half at the Naval Hospital in Chelsea. And became pretty well dug in there because I was in, at that time, the ancillary departments like the laboratory and surgery and those, they were kind of, they were special, you know. And to be on a team like that, well, you were kind of special. I never felt special because getting up 2 in the morning, emergency, I didn't think that was special at all. But we never fussed about it. No, we did it.
With war.
We did it. I tell you, I never recall where I had to take somebody by the nape of the neck and take him to work. Never. I was usually the senior one, and all of us in surgery were housed in one area, and I'd come down the hall yelling at 2 o'clock in the morning, emergency, and boy, they'd be up just like that. Same way with personnel down in the laboratory. That goes hand in hand. Anytime you have an emergency, the laboratory's got to get up at the same time.
Well, after that year and a half at Chelsea, then what?
I went to Williamsburg, Virginia. Well, it was Camp Perry, exactly, to join up with the Seabees.
For people who aren't too familiar, that means?
The Seabees, that's a construction battalion. And most generally at that time they were going to the South Pacific, and they were they were there before the Marines were there. They were building docks where there were no docks and all that sort of thing. And I hung in there, but I learned something again about our country right quick. Going from Boston to Virginia, I rode a train. Got to Maryland, the biggest commotion you ever saw on that passenger train. All the blacks were going back to the back of the train. All the whites were going forward. That's the first time I'd personally known about Jim Crow law. And where I was born and raised, we just never tolerated that. So that when I saw that, I got almost, well, I was so ill at ease. But I was sensitive enough about everything wrong. There was no use to try to do anything about it. But I felt so bad because here I am in a country that's going to war against all sorts of isms, and yet here we got one of this kind in our own, you know.
That was before civil rights.
Oh, yeah. See, this was back in 43.
Mm-hmm.
When I got to Virginia, I went to Richmond the first weekend because I had left my wife in Boston. I was in search for a place to rent, stay. I knew I was short. I knew I was going to be going overseas before long, but I thought, well, I'll make the best of it, you know. It was in Richmond I found a realtor. He had a little shop there, office, rather. An old southern gentleman. He had a white, snow-white beard, snow-white hair, looked like the Kentucky Colonel. I made my point. I was looking for a place to live for my wife and I. He didn't respond by saying he didn't have one. He says, "You're one of them damn Yankees, huh?" I said, "Thanks a lot. I'll be seeing you." Mm-hmm. I just left him.
Mm-hmm.
That was my first experience of that.
Mm-hmm.
Then I took a notion to see Richmond. This was on a Sunday night. I was all by myself. I was walking up the main street of Richmond. Everybody dressed in their finest. It was around church hour. And there were quite a few blacks in Richmond. And when I would come up the street, if they were coming down towards me on the sidewalk, they'd just step off into the off the street. Right there again, I mean, I was confronted. But I had a little inkling of it by reading some of the books that I had read. I knew about the Jim Crow law, but I had never experienced it. This is what I was experiencing now. And if you don't think that it was enforced, they had this one part of it that said, don't get caught downtown before the sun sets. Have you ever heard that?
No.
Towards evening, everybody, all the blacks had to return to their area where they lived. It could not be downtown after that. And, well, I have seen that develop from that now to what we have today.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a long ways to go.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not where we're on now.
You went to your new assignment then?
I didn't go to CB's. But for some reason or another, and for many times in my career, I saw the same hand of fate, not fate, but favor, go to work on me. I was delegated to go with that CB unit. And in the last minute, something happened, and I'll tell you what happened. They were holding a bond drive, and the personnel officer of the base that I was personnel with was a bond officer. You remember those bonds?
Yes.
They sold? Well, we were buying bonds. My wife was doing the buying of the bonds. So I wasn't interested. So he hurried up my orders. He put me on another slate, and I got transferred back up to Norfolk. And there they were forming this hospital unit to send overseas into North Africa. And that's where I went.
Well, you must have had experiences there.
Oh, yeah, it was in September of 43, and I came back in August of 45. And I was slated to be in charge of the operating room. I got over there, and all we had was rocks and stones. There wasn't a single thing up. But eventually, the good CBs came and set up Quonset huts. And I was given three Quonset huts to arrange. I had to almost design the interior of them as far as partitions and everything were concerned, cabinets and so forth. That was going to be the operating rooms.
What part of North Africa was this?
It was 6 miles inland from Oran, that's in Algeria.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We had a it was referred to as a naval base hospital there. And Oran was quite active port for Navy transport. They would bring a lot of supplies in, mm-hmm. both for Army and Navy. The Army had already come through, and the big names in the Army expeditions down there, such as Eisenhower, the Desert Wolf from Germany, what was his name?
Rommel.
He
wasn't
had just
he a fox? I believe he
Desert
was a fox.
Uh-huh. Desert Fox. Yes, and then we were assisting with that naval base in treating some of those emergency army. They got swamped there for a while, and they were sending them back west. Mm-hmm. That we would get them to a point where we could evacuate. Now, we had an airport about 13 miles. Mass like it was. Everybody, we acted goofy sometimes because we sometimes were so tired. I can recall that operating room was almost exhausted of supplies and dirty as a dickens, and we had been on there almost 72 hours, the whole crew, no rest. The chief surgery was the same as all, and I had a supply of the highest proof alcohol. We used that to for antiseptic purposes. And he just jarred me to no end. He told me to go get some grapefruit juice when we were so tired, and he had permitted me to pour out some of that alcohol in the grapefruit juice. And I don't know whether they got tired or drunk, but anyway, it helped. But this, again, I am always so impressed by the dedication that we had there in those days. We had a contingent of nurses there, 19 nurses, and that was it. I mean, there wasn't a single other female friend in the area, and they were really, how should I say, almost locked in. They had 2-3 huts there, and that's where they had to stay, and then they walked to work between working place. And I've seen them so desperately lonesome, so desperately exhausted that they were almost wishing to be destroyed. That's how stressful it was. And I don't know, I never got into that state of mind. I never got into it, and it was a good thing in a way, because I was a lot of consolation for them. I had five of the total number of nurses in the surgical suite. And we would have our good times. So what I'm saying is that we would have our base parties and things when it was predicted safe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the worst casualties we ever had was right at the time of one of those parties. I had to get up and call the whole surgical mm-hmm. staff down. We had a truck go over with 30-some men over a cliff into the sea, about 50-60 feet, and so it was just at war with mass casualty.
Hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
But
well, if you were there until 1946, that was after the war was over, right?
I was there in 1945.
45.
Yeah.
But the war.
The war was. I know the war was over. We were, I told you, 6 miles from Iran. In the community of Iran, there's a peak that's probably 150 feet high. And at the top of that, they had a shrine. It was a religious shrine. When World War II broke out in Europe, the light that had always been burning in that shrine went out. When word was received that the war was declared over in Europe, we saw a torch march from the base of that mountain to the peak of that mountain at night to light that torch again. That was one of the unforgettable happenings. These were the people who lived in the area. Oh, I'm sure there were some of the others who joined with them. I was too far away to get with it, but we could see it from where we were. It was impressive.
Well, then were you sent back to the United States?
Yes, I was. I was sent back on a LST, is one of the slow boats to China. They didn't care to hurry us back, I tell you. Oh, going over.
Excuse me, Dan. Now, you know, I have an idea what that is because I lived at that time. But for people who aren't familiar, LST?
Landing ship. Oh, no. Tank.
Uh huh. Landing
ship tank. They hauled. They carried tanks.
Yeah.
They had a door that would drop down in the front, and the tanks would just roll
mm-hmm.
off. Yeah, landing ship tank.
Uh-huh.
It was, I didn't think I could remember that now. But we
came home in one of those.
Yes, and I had to get on in the Mediterranean. Have you been in the Mediterranean?
Yes.
Have you ever been in a storm in the Mediterranean?
No, thank goodness.
It's worse than the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
I got into a storm. I didn't think I was even going to make it to Gibraltar. But anyways, we made that, and we got out and dilly-dallied along back and came into New York Harbor at the base of the Statue of Liberty. We hear about no fanfare today. You know what they did to us? They put us off on a barge with all our crusty gear and towed us up to one of the piers on the Hudson River side of New York and pulled us up alongside there and dumped us. And that
uh-huh.
was the atmosphere greeting we got.
Your homecoming.
That was my homecoming. So things didn't change much in all those years.
Well, where were you sent then?
Well, because I was one of those last of the Mohicans, I had to be put to work. So we had a real exodus of servicemen going out, leaving the service, of course. And they were going to certain points in the United States for disbursement back in. They had to be processed, you know, mm-hmm. in a certain amount. And I got the run of taking back trainloads of men from New York to Chicago. They were all Navy, and they were all going back to Great Lakes. And I was the medical representative on that train. Anybody needed attention, I would have to do it. It wasn't fun going out. It was one of those old, cold, Lackawanna trains, and they were war trains of them, so. But I liked to come back. I always rode on New York Central Commodore. First class Pullman, and that wasn't bad. I made trips there for about 6 months, mm-hmm. and then I was reassigned again.
And where was that then?
I was at a hospital base in Central New York, near the Five Finger Lakes, if you're familiar with them.
Yeah, I know the area.
Geneva, New York is close by. And I was back again there to supervising an operating room. Of course, we had new nurses there, but I was, at that time, I had reached the mm-hmm. highest rank, so I was really more of a personnel administrator mm-hmm. of the operating room crew than I was supervisor of the operating room. And that was a hospital that dealt mainly in the treatment of tuberculosis. I hadn't realized there was tuberculosis in the Navy, but I found out there we had many.
Then?
I left from there and I went to the big hospital in St. Albans, New York, Long Island. And there, that was in 46. It was still full of casualties post-war. Mm-hmm. They were phasing out. I mean, we were getting them back to health, but it was still pretty full. And what made it worse than ever was, I told you there was an exodus of the Navy out. Well, we had the same thing happen in the medical department. So that we didn't have enough people, mm-hmm. nurses and whatever. And I was more administrative there. I had a heavy responsibility there to try to keep the ship afloat with people to do the work. It really was a job, because we hadn't gotten things going yet to where we were getting people coming back in. Mm-hmm. Some of them were coming back. Mm-hmm. Those that I wish they'd never gone, you know. Mm-hmm. And by that time then, the Department of Defense was realizing the problem we were in. They opened it up again mm-hmm. for those to come back. Yeah. And that was the relief. After I was in St. Albans until 48. Winter 48, right at Christmas time, no less. My family was comfortably in a home we bought in St. Albans. I got orders to go with a fighter squadron. Naval Air Force, and my first stop was in Quonset Point, Rhode Island. Mm. first experience was about a month later. I found myself on a carrier heading for the Caribbean with that carrier air group at Air Force. And you talk about heart in your mouth. I don't know which is worse, facing the plane coming, cartwheeling down the deck on a carrier than facing the enemy coming down. But,
48, what was the fighting squadron doing then?
Well, I can sum it up in one word. Prepare. It goes on 24 hours a day. Even at this day, it still goes that way. I can look back and realize that a third of my life was spent preparing for the next expedition. I had the privilege of being with the squadron that got the first jets, fighter planes. I entered the jet age with them. We were transferred to Jacksonville, Florida. That was a large Naval Air Force base there. And a lot of training went on there. Pensacola, of course, was the school for training pilots. But Jacksonville, Florida was the base for full training. Pilots flying and ground crew preparing the planes and all that sort of thing.
Well, Don, maybe we could, you were probably at other places too, but maybe we could go now to when you came to Decatur. How about that?
Yeah, I'm not too far back there. Before I come back to Decatur, though.
All right,
go ahead. There's one thing that I learned, even before and after I was in Decatur. I was in Vietnam too. And that is that okay people are okay no matter where in the world we are. I've always had friends I always remember, I don't care where in the world I was. And I've had to cry with them, I've had to laugh with them, and they do the same. I don't criticize anybody, but I think to appreciate anything, but especially people, you have to be there. You have to be there in their environment. You have to be there with their culture. You just have to be there. It's the same as it is in battle. It's the same as it is even having a baby. Who knows to have a baby if you never had a baby? And so, I just want to insert that part of it. That's kind of a personal observation that I've learned and I live by. My philosophy is that you're my friend until you proved otherwise. And I have had some pretty dangerous experiences with that, but I've gotten around it. No, we want to get back to Decatur.
Okay. What was Decatur like during those years, when you first came here?
I should say a little subdued after I had been to New York and Boston and Washington.
What year was it?
56. Mm-hmm. Some of the local people call it an old-grown country town. I didn't buy that. That was before the landmark wall. It was before the Civic Center and all those things that have been added to it. The growth of it, I've watched it just mushroom out. I believe that it's kept up well. The schools have kept up with the demand for schools. You can see it now. They're going to have to close back a little bit because they have a little more space than they need. But they'll come and probably have to open it up again. Anything that goes, grows. And I think people will be always, I've always had the feeling when a city reaches 100,000, there's no stopping it. It won't die. No way will it die. It may have its highs and lows, everything does, but it won't die. I think it depends on the motive of other people, how they're motivated to want to live. If they want to have a good life, they'll make it that way.
What were your duties in Decatur?
Well, basically, to attend to those naval personnel who were stationed there. We had the permanent personnel stationed there.
Here, you mean, in Decatur?
Here in Decatur at Lakeshore Drive.
Mm-hmm.
But I also had to conduct the physicals, and I had a doctor working, and Dennis both working with me. Of the new recruits who come into the reserve, and that was, we had meetings every Tuesday night, so that meant that many nights a month that I had to give to the center. But although I was every day, every working day, I was down there all day long. But on top of that, I also was under the jurisdiction of the regional Navy, which put me in an area, in a region, where if an active duty Navy personnel or Marine personnel became ill or was injured or was killed, I had to intervene. And it would be to make arrangements for hospitalization or the other, you know. And that was quite frequent because my area was large. It was all the way to Shelbyville, all the way up to Bloomington, and about the same east and west.
When did you retire from this position?
I didn't. I didn't retire from here.
Oh, you didn't?
No. I left here.
You came back to Decatur then after retirement.
Right.
I see. Well, we are flattered that you chose Decatur then.
I left here and but I was ordered with the Marines in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. This was right around Korea. I told you I had kind of a very guided life, it seemed like. I was with a unit that had orders to go to Korea. We were on a ship in the Atlantic with orders sealed to go around. Never went.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I came back to the States, I was time up for sea duty, and I went assigned to shore duty again. Well, back around again to another ship, that was another 3 years. And then, let's see, from there, I had a little pause in my active duty. I was struck down with cataracts of both eyes and had to have them removed, and I was 80 days out of active in hospital up here at Great Lakes, and I was carrying a set of orders for the Bureau of Medicine Surgery in Washington, D.C., and I kind of halfway wished they'd cancel them. They wouldn't cancel them. And I ended up spending 5 years in the Bureau of Medicine and Surgery in Washington, D.C., which didn't hurt me a bit. As it turned out, I happened to be one, I'm the first one that the physical evaluation unit there in the Bureau put back to duty after they'd had cataracts. And guess where they put me back to duty? On board a hospital ship in Vietnam.
Oh, Vietnam?
With these eyes, top of my forehead is still sore, I'm hitting those beams that come down. That, plus a year after Vietnam up at Great Lakes, I retired from Great Lakes, where I started in 1942.
Yeah. That was quite a circle.
Yeah. It was full circle.
Mm-hmm. Well, Don, you have many civic and community projects and groups that you're interested in here in Decatur. How did that happen?
I think it kind of naturally falls into the category of experience that I've had. Usually I had to care for people who depended on somebody, and so I naturally came into, when I retired, I didn't have, I wasn't going to work anymore. I just made that up. I was sure. But I had to have something to do, and the Office on Aging just started up. I have been doing a little bit of reading on some of the projects and programs that were being planned nationally. And so I just got connected with them, and it took off from there. And it hasn't stopped. I mean, it just really adds on. I was one time a state ombudsman for nursing homes. That was a natural. I walked into that and it just fell into it. I mean, we had some orientation and some training before we went into it to qualify. But I related to those older people. It goes back way, way back when I was a child. When I was a child, we respected our elders, we respected our grandparents. I tell you, my grandmother was queen. Mm-hmm. And she lived to be 91 years old. And she still walked. Mm-hmm. And she died. But that comes back on me. That came back on me. And So everybody's my grandmother.
Well, you have made a real contribution to Decatur. You are the president of the Decatur Senior Citizen Council, and you are still with the Office of Aging, aren't you?
Yes, I'm on the Aging Advisory Commission now.
Yes.
I'm not really doing practicing work out of there like I was. I was 7 years with them, though.
Yes.
I was one of the original volunteers with the Office of Aging.
So you have really made a contribution. And have you enjoyed retirement?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I never think I'm retired. I wonder sometimes if I shouldn't be punching the clock.
Well, you almost are.
Yeah, I really am. This week now, 6 days straight, every day I've dressed up to go somewhere. Now, this was fun. I just shouldn't say the other wasn't, but this was relaxing.
Now, one question I didn't ask you that I want to, how does life in the service affect family life?
That's a good question. I've always said there has to be special wives to be a serviceman's wife.
And you were fortunate.
I was fortunate. I have been on large ships. I'm talking about carriers now, where there's 4,000 or more. And see the lineup of married men strained with information from home, either directly from their family or some legal agency or something. Financial, oh, you name it, problems. All my years, I never had one phone call. Never.
But you have to have an understanding family.
Well, my wife is the type that when I'm home, it's your job, Buster. When I leave, she takes over. Well, she's had enough training, she had enough education, so that it never was a problem.
Oh, right.
She made out the income tax report,
good.
She owed taxes, take care of everything.
Well, Don, I think you've had a marvelous life, and you really have made a real contribution other places, but especially here in Decatur. We certainly appreciate these reminiscences that you've given us. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Betty. I just want to close by repeating what I told my wife this morning. I don't know what time I'll be home. If she goes for 30 years, it might take 30 years to tell her.
Well,
I didn't realize how my recall was.
Yeah.
It's the first time I've really been nailed down for a recall that long.
Well, it's good to have it on the record, and that is one of the purposes of these oral history programs.
There are many, so many experiences I have happened on to, which I see now were already working then. I'm talking about some of the problems like we are having down in Central America. I was down there in Central America when we had riots on the street in Panama.
Yeah.
That was back in 48, 49.
So you see the whole picture.
Yeah. We were having maneuvers on the shores of Libya. Now, Gaddafi was, you know what? See, our history. I could add not a lot to history books just that way.
I'm sure you could. Well, thank you very much for what you've given us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the reminiscences of Don Opadal, and this is Betty Turnell speaking for the Decatur Public Library.